This is Dr. Ralph Wilson with the Jesus Walk Bible Study Series. We're studying 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus, and this is the introduction to the pastoral epistles. Before we get into 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus, it's best to deal with some of the overall general questions about these letters. This will help us understand better what we are reading when we get to the letters themselves. 1 and 2 Timothy, along with Titus, are known as the pastoral epistles. Incidentally, pronounced pastoral rather than pastoral, look it up. Because they consist largely of pastoral advice on how to deal with problems in churches, both in Ephesus and in Crete. These three epistles have a lot in common with each other. Kummel summarized it this way. They presuppose the same false teachers, the same organization, and entirely similar conditions in the community. They move within the same relative theological concepts and have the same peculiarities of language and style. The texts of 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus all clearly state in the first verse of each letter that they are written by the Apostle Paul. The early church clearly accepted them as genuinely Pauline. They were probably known to the author of 1 Clement, 96 A.D. Several passages in the letters of Ignatius, 110 A.D., seem to show dependence on them. Polycarp of Smyrna, 117 A.D., cited them, as did Justin Martyr, 140 A.D. They were rejected by the heretical Marcion Canon, 150 A.D., according to Tertullian, because of their emphasis on church discipline. They are clearly attributed to Paul by Irenaeus, 180 A.D. It was not until Schleiermacher in the 19th century that their authenticity was questioned. Today, a majority of New Testament scholars consider them to be written by a disciple of Paul, not Paul himself. I disagree. I believe that Paul wrote the pastoral epistles. I will outline the arguments for and against Pauline authorship below. There is no dispute, however, that the pastoral epistles were accepted by the early church as written by Paul himself. 1 and 2 Timothy are so named because they are addressed to Timothy, Paul's traveling companion and assistant on his missionary journeys. In 1 Timothy, Paul, who has gone on to Macedonia, asks Timothy to remain in Ephesus in order to deal with the false teachers that have arisen there. It is important to recognize, however, that 1 Timothy, at least, is not intended for Timothy's eyes only. Again and again, Paul underscores both his own authority and that of Timothy, with the assumption that this letter would be read by the church itself. The book of Titus is addressed to a co-worker, Titus, who has ministered with Paul in Crete and was directed to stay there to appoint elders and teach sound doctrine in the churches there. Timothy, whose name means honoring God or venerating God, was born to a mixed marriage of a Jewish mother and a Greek unbelieving father. His family lived in the city of Lystra. On Paul's first missionary journey to this city, Timothy, with his mother Eunice and his maternal grandmother Lois, became believers. When Paul visits Lystra on his second missionary journey, he recognizes the spiritual growth that has taken place in this young man in the intervening years. Paul sees in Timothy the makings of an associate who can help him in his missionary endeavors. It may sound strange to us, but one of the qualifications Timothy had to meet in order to work with Paul was to be circumcised. Since Timothy was Jewish through his mother, he could hardly work with Paul in the synagogues of the Mediterranean as an uncircumcised Jew. Timothy is probably commissioned by Paul and the elders in his home church of Lystra. There is a word of prophecy over him, the laying on of hands, and the impartation of a spiritual gift, perhaps that of evangelist. And so the partnership begins. Timothy travels with Paul's party as an assistant, apprentice, and protege, and he gradually proves himself to be a trusted minister in his own right. He travels with Paul and Silas to Philippi and Berea, and joins Paul at Athens. Then he is sent to encourage the church at Thessalonica, and is later with Paul and Silas in Corinth. On Paul's third missionary journey, Timothy plays an important role too. He is sent ahead to Philippi, then travels to meet Paul, is with Paul in Corinth, and travels with him to Philippi before Paul returns to Jerusalem and imprisonment. When Paul is sent in chains to Rome for trial, Timothy is there with him. He is a great comfort. Paul writes during this time, Philippians 2:20-22, I have no one else like him who takes a genuine interest in your welfare. For everyone looks out for his own interests, not those of Jesus Christ, but you know that Timothy has proved himself, because as a son with his father, he has served with me in the work of the gospel. It appears that Paul was released from his first imprisonment in Rome. See more on this below. At this time, the pair splits up. Paul returns to Philippi, while Timothy is dispatched to Ephesus to deal with false teachers who have established some following there. Timothy has his work cut out for him. Paul exhorts him to let no one despise his youth as he appoints elders and deacons, corrects elders bringing false teaching, and regulates care for the church widows. Timothy is still in Ephesus when Paul is imprisoned in Rome, apparently for a second time, and writes his final letter, 2 Timothy. Later, Timothy spends some time in prison himself, according to Hebrews 13:23. After that, his history gets fuzzy. Church tradition records that he serves as bishop of Ephesus until 80 AD, when he is beaten to death by pagans. We know much less about Titus than we do Timothy. Titus, Greek Titas, Latin Titus, was a common Roman name from the Latin Titulus, title of honor. Titus probably came to Christ during the revival in Antioch about 45 AD or later, apparently a convert of Paul himself, since Paul refers to him as my true son in our common faith. He accompanied Paul and Barnabas on their trip from Antioch to the Jerusalem Council about 49 AD, concerning whether Gentile Christians must be circumcised. It was determined that Titus, who was an uncircumcised Greek believer, need not be circumcised. He was a valued co-worker whom Paul sent on sensitive missions to Corinth, so it is a mystery that he is not mentioned in the book of Acts. Paul apparently travels with Titus to Crete following Paul's first release from imprisonment in Rome, and leaves him there to set the church in order. Later, Paul sends him to Dalmatia. Paul refers to him as both a brother as well as a partner and fellow worker. Titus has the heart of a pastor and an earnest devotion to the church, to his friends, and to its leaders. According to a late 9th century subscription to a Greek manuscript of the Epistle of Titus, Titus was the first bishop of Crete. The letters of 1 and 2 Timothy are written to Timothy while he served as Paul's appointed leader of the church of Ephesus. We'll look at Paul's circumstances as he wrote the letters below, but first let's consider the historical situation of the church in Ephesus. Ephesus was a wealthy city located on the western coast of Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey, on the banks of the Caistor River as it enters the Mediterranean, forming an ample harbor. It was an important city, serving as the capital of Proconsular Asia, a Roman province. It probably had a population of about 500,000. The Ephesians worshipped the goddess Artemis, Diana, whose temple in Ephesus at the time was one of the 7 wonders of the ancient world. It was also home to Hellenistic mystery religions as well as the residence of many Jews. Each of these exerted its influence on the religious climate of the city. Acts 19 tells the story of Paul's 2-year ministry founding the church in Ephesus, probably about 53 to 54 AD. The city was so important to Paul and early Christianity that it was the recipient of 4 letters that exist today. 1, Paul's letter to Ephesians. 2, Paul's letter to 1 Timothy. 2 Timothy was addressed primarily to Timothy himself while he served as the leader of the church in Ephesus. 1 John was probably written by the Apostle John as a circular letter to the churches in the area, with Ephesus as the most important. John apparently lived there for a number of years, and it is his traditional burial place. And 4, letters to the seven churches of Revelation has Ephesus as the first church addressed, encouraged, and admonished. This important church was subject to winds of heresy from both Judaism on the one hand and the Hellenistic mystery religions on the other. Correction of the false teachers was necessary for the church to survive intact. The historical setting of 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus raises some difficult issues. The book of Acts, which chronicles Paul's ministry, ends with him under house arrest in Rome, awaiting trial. I'm reading Acts 28:30-31. For 2 whole years, Paul stayed there in his own rented house and welcomed all who came to see him. Boldly and without hindrance, he preached the gospel of God and taught about the Lord Jesus Christ. Some scholars have assumed that this was Paul's final imprisonment. But there are several indications to the contrary in both the pastoral epistles as well as early church tradition. Here is a possible chronology of this period. 60 to 62 AD, first imprisonment, house arrest in Rome, for 2 years. He wrote Philippians and perhaps Ephesians and Colossians here. 62 to 64, possible mission to Spain, second Aegean ministry, Achaia, Crete, Macedonia, Nicopolis, Miletus, and Troas. 62 to 64, wrote 1 Timothy and Titus. 64, July, the outbreak of Nero's persecution, fire at Rome. 65 to 67, second imprisonment in Rome, wrote 2 Timothy. 65 to 67, execution in Rome during the 14th year of Nero, according to Eusebius' Chronicle. 68, the death of Nero, and 67 to 70, the siege and fall of Jerusalem. Of course, this reconstruction is speculative. We can't know for sure. Unlike some of the other churches Paul had founded, the false teachers he opposed in the letters to Timothy were primarily insiders, not teachers from outside the church. Most dangerously, these false teachers were the elders or overseers themselves. The church in Ephesus and in other cities was probably composed of house churches, each presided over by an elder. These elders were in turn influencing other elders and house churches. Paul had foreseen these problems years before, as he had met with them on the beach at Miletus for the last time. He told them, Acts 20:29-30, I know that after I leave, savage wolves will come in among you and will not spare the flock. Even from your own number, men will rise and distort the truth in order to draw away disciples after them. Now it had come to pass, and Timothy, as Paul's most trusted co-worker, had been appointed to deal with it. From 1 Timothy, we deduce several things about false teachers. One, those spreading error were teachers and therefore probably elders, since teaching was primarily a task of the elders. Two, one of Paul's emphases in this letter concerns the character qualifications and discipline of church leaders, namely overseers, pastors, elders, and deacons. Three, two ringleaders have been named and excommunicated. Four, the false teacher's most fruitful field is apparently among women in the congregation. Five, the false teachers seem to have a Jewish cast. Paul doesn't give us a list of the false teaching that Timothy was charged to combat in Ephesus, so we must develop our list in two ways. One, specific mentions of false teachings, and two, reading between the lines to discern from the corrective teachings that Paul gives Timothy. In compiling this list, I am drawing upon direct statements and hints in all three of the pastoral epistles. Of course, 1 and 2 Timothy were written to the situation in Ephesus, and Titus to the situation in Crete, but the problem seems similar. Our first inclination is to look for blatant heresies, that is, teachings that cut to the heart of the nature of God and of Christ, denying Christ's divinity, for example, but that isn't what we see here. The false teachings are more subtle than that. Towner characterizes the Ephesian heresy as follows. A form of aberrant Judaism with Hellenistic Gnostic tendencies that overemphasized the law and underemphasized Christ and faith taught dualism, asceticism, denial of physical resurrection, and was unduly interested in the minutiae of the Old Testament, produced sinful lifestyles and irrelevant quibbling about words, and was destroying the reputation of the church in Ephesus. Specifically, perhaps the most obvious false teaching has to do with the strong emphasis on Jewish myths and genealogies. 1 Timothy 1:4, nor to devote themselves to myths and endless genealogies, 1 Timothy 4:7, have nothing to do with godless myths and old wives' tales. 2 Timothy 4:7, they will turn their ears away from the truth and turn aside to myths. Titus 3:9, avoid foolish controversies and genealogies. We may find this hard to understand, but consider all the genealogies in the Old Testament and even the New. Jews who could prove their genealogical descent from the patriarchs considered themselves superior. This had been overemphasized in Ephesus and Crete among the Jewish Christians. Jewish myths may have included various Jewish allegories of creation, perhaps speculative rabbinic exegesis. Jewish pseudepigraphical writings from the 1st and 2nd centuries AD are full of such stories. 2. Jewish legalism. There seems to be a kind of false teaching related to a use of the Old Testament, insisting on adherence to Mosaic ritual law, kosher food, circumcision, etc. 1 Timothy 1:7, they want to be teachers of the law, but they do not know what they are talking about or what they so confidently affirm. Titus 1:10, for there are many rebellious people, mere talkers and deceivers, especially those of the circumcision group. Titus 3:9, arguments and quarrels about the law. 1 Timothy 4:3, they order them to abstain from certain foods which God created to be received with thanksgiving. Titus 1:14, the commands of those who reject the truth. We see Paul combating a similar kind of legalism in Colossae. Downplaying the role of marriage. Third, these teachers downplay the role of marriage, a kind of asceticism. 1 Timothy 4:3, they forbid people to marry. It may be similar to the situation Paul addressed in 1 Corinthians 7:1-7. It is probably no coincidence that Paul stresses the importance of faithfulness to one's marriage and careful management of one's household for overseers and elders and deacons. Perhaps this false teaching extended to childbirth as well, occasioning Paul's example concerning childbirth in 1 Timothy 2:15. 4. Ethical relativism and greed. Paul taught that the ritual laws were obsolete in the Messianic age, while the ethical laws remained. The false teachers seemed to teach the opposite, that the ritual laws were binding, but conduct wasn't as important. Titus 1:6. They claim to know God, but by their actions they deny him. They are detestable, disobedient, and unfit for doing anything good. There's the suggestion of taking advantage of some of the church women, perhaps sexually. Paul's guidelines for leaders presuppose ethical and behavior problems, for Paul writes in 1 Timothy 3:2-3. Now the overseer must be above reproach, the husband of but one wife, temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not given to drunkenness, not violent but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. Twice more, Paul warns Timothy about the dangers of the love of money, so we can assume that this is one of the heresies being promulgated in Ephesus. 5. Mistaken eschatology. Paul's opponents in Ephesus taught that the resurrection had already come, that is, that we no longer look forward to Christ's coming, judgment, and resurrection of the dead. 2 Timothy 2:18. They say that the resurrection has already taken place, and they destroy the faith of some. This may have similarities with teachings in Corinth, that denied the resurrection of the dead at all. Two church members had already been excommunicated for such teaching that was causing major problems with some of the members' faith. There are some indications that Paul is dealing with an early form of Gnosticism here that deprecates physical matter, for example, not full-blown Gnosticism, as it would appear a century later, but beginning strands of the opposing ideas of what is falsely called knowledge, 1 Timothy 6:20. 6. Neglect of evangelism. Finally, there is an indication that the false teachers were so immersed in speculative controversies that they neglected the very core of the Christian faith, a situation not unfamiliar today. Why else would Paul talk about his own salvation and then make the point, 1 Timothy 1:15, here is a trustworthy saying that deserves full acceptance. Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am the worst. Finally, he exhorts Timothy, 2 Timothy 4:5, endure hardship, do the work of an evangelist, discharge all the duties of your ministry. The gospel, it is always on Paul's mind. It is his theme, his message, and is so easy for us to dismiss as old hat. It is hard to characterize the heresy at Ephesus in any clear, simple way. Lightfoot correctly describes it as floating speculation, vague theories, coalescing gradually to a great consistency and tendency, more or less in one direction. The primary purpose of 1 Timothy is to urge Paul's appointed representative to stop the false teaching. The secondary purpose is to provide written authorization before the church to allow Timothy to carry out this task. He is also to regulate appointment of elders and deacons. The purpose of 2 Timothy is more personal, primarily to call Timothy to his side and to exhort him to faithfulness in his ministry. Paul has seen many defections and desertions during his second imprisonment. He appeals to Timothy's loyalty and longs for him to come to him in Rome. Titus is written to encourage the teaching of sound doctrine and appointment of leaders in the churches following Paul's ministry with Titus in Crete. He also requests Titus to come to him in Rome. Before we conclude, we need to look at various arguments that have been raised against Paul's authorship of the pastoral epistles. In short, here they are. 1. A significant part of the characteristic words of the pastoral epistles is new vocabulary, and the new terms seem to represent more the language of Hellenism or Hellenistic Judaism. For example, instead of faith, the author tends to use godliness. Instead of the gospel, we see sound teaching, sound-minded, and related words predominate as virtues. 2. Much of Paul's rich theological vocabulary is lacking, such as those words used to develop themes such as righteousness, justification, etc. 3. Stylistic features of Greek grammar that are common to the pastoral epistles are different than in Paul's earlier letters. These observations are true, though they are often overstated by opponents of Pauline authorship. But assuming a different author creates other problems. It is preferable to explain the differences by Paul's use of a different amanuensis or secretary, as well as the more personal rather than theological nature of these letters. Opponents of Pauline authorship claim that the pastoral epistles were written by a pseudepigraphic writer, perhaps a disciple of Paul, who wrote at the end of the first century. To put it bluntly, they argue that a later writer claiming to be Paul wrote the letters, that pseudepigraphy was common and accepted in the early church. However, we know that many bogus letters or gospels suspected of being written by someone claiming to be an apostle were detected and rejected out of hand by the early church. The early church did not accept pseudepigraphic writings as scripture. Moreover, this assertion of pseudepigraphy creates other problems. 1. The letters are far more Pauline than not in language, style, and theology. 2. The historical situation of the Ephesian church, presupposed in 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus, fits the period of the 60s much better than it fits what we know of the situation at the end of the first century when critics claim it was written. 3. There is no adequate occasion and purpose for a pseudepigraphic author to have written these letters, in particular, 3 such letters. The argument that the author used some genuine fragments of Pauline letters doesn't explain the questions of occasion and purpose. Added to that, the nearly unanimous acceptance of the letters as Pauline in the early church, I conclude that the letters are genuine from the person of Paul himself, despite the differences between the pastoral epistles and Paul's earlier letters. May God bless you as you study these.